From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Wednesday, October 7th, 2015. And on this day, the U.S. Coast Guard suspends its search for 33 missing mariners, including four from Maine, who were lost when the El Faro sank last week in Hurricane Joaquin. One Maine toddler has died and another is critically ill with E. coli, and state officials want to know how they caught the deadly bacteria. And a new initiative to tax the wealthy to boost state education funding. That and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible in part by listeners like you and by Lee Auto Malls, serving Maine since 1936 and a proud supporter of MPBN Radio, with locations throughout the state and online at leeauto.com.
I'm Barbara Caridi. The U.S. Coast Guard is ending its search for 33 missing crew members from the cargo ship El Faro, which sank last week during Hurricane Joaquin. Four of the missing mariners, including the ship's captain, are from Maine and all graduated from Maine Maritime Academy in Castine. At a press conference this afternoon in Jacksonville, Florida, U.S. Coast Guard Captain Mark Fedor said the Coast Guard will end its search for survivors this evening at 7.
I want the families to really know how committed we were to finding their loved ones, to finding our fellow professional mariners and do work upon great waters. I hope the families can take some small measure of peace from that.
Members of Maine's congressional delegation were briefed earlier on the status of the investigation into the sinking of the ship. Maine First District Representative Shelley Pingree says lawmakers were told that the Navy will be enlisted to help search for the ship's black box recorder.
It does have a lot of basic navigation information, and it also captures a voice recording from 12 hours prior to when the ship hit the water or when the box hits the water. So that could be some very important data and a lot of critical information about the conversations that went on in the bridge.
The 790-foot cargo ship sank Thursday after becoming disabled in the hurricane, a Category 4 storm with 140-mile-an-hour winds and 50-foot waves. The water in the area is 15,000 feet deep, and federal officials say determining what happened to the El Faro could take as long as 18 months. A different kind of investigation is underway in Maine. State officials are trying to figure out how two toddlers were infected with the often deadly bacteria E. coli. The illness claimed the life of a 20-month-old boy on Monday, and another toddler is in critical condition at Maine Medical Center. The common link between the two children is that they both visited a petting zoo at a local fair. As the state investigates to determine the source of the infections, physicians are emphasizing safety measures individuals can take to prevent E. coli infections. Patty White reports.
John Gay of Poland says he took his son Colton to the Oxford County Fair on two separate days during the third week of September.
And part of that, just normal family fun day, was to go visit the animals and the petting zoo.
Within a week, Colton became ill with cold-like symptoms. When he started to have bloody diarrhea, Gay says their doctor admitted Colton to a hospital.
And that started essentially a week of terror and panic as we tried to figure out what was going on with our son. And we later found out he contracted HUS.
HUS, or hemolytic uremic syndrome, is a toxin that's produced by E. coli that causes kidney failure, says Dr. Dora Ann Mills, the vice president of clinical affairs at the University of New England and a former director of the Maine CDC. Mills says E. coli are part of the normal bacteria in human and animal intestines, but
some are very pathogenic, meaning they can cause illness and can cause very severe illness, particularly those types of E. coli that you can find in other animals besides, you know, humans.
Food, including undercooked beef, is a common source of E. coli infections in humans, but animals can also be a source. John Gay suspects the petting zoo because while Colton was being treated at Maine Medical Center, Gay met another family whose son is also battling HUS. After comparing notes, Gay says the petting zoo was the common link.
We even compared the food we ate at the fair, and nothing seemed to match.
State veterinarian Michelle Walsh says one of the best ways to prevent E. coli infection from animals is to wash hands after touching them.
we'll continue to try to make this message fresh and new, and make sure that facilities are available, readily available at all these animal exhibitions. It's really important.
John Gay says his son did wash his hands after the petting zoo, but he still developed HUS and the illness took his life on Monday morning. The state CDC would not comment specifically on the individual HUS cases other than to confirm that it's investigating two cases from Androscoggin County. As Gay waits for solid answers, he says he wants to raise awareness so that other parents can either avoid exposing their children to E. coli or take preventive measures. For MPBN News, I'm Patty White.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has concluded that the American eel does not need protection under the Endangered Species Act, but the agency is recommending that harvest levels be monitored and that passage be eased at hydroelectric facilities to ensure the long-term stability of the biologically important species. Susan Sharon reports.
The announcement follows an in-depth status review of a 2010 petition to list the eel as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. Peer-reviewed by several federal agencies, the assessment concluded that the eel's overall population is stable and not in danger of extinction or likely to become endangered within the foreseeable future. Maine is one of two states that still has a commercial harvest for elvers or baby eels.
We still are seeing local mortality from both harvest and hydroelectric facilities, but we're seeing that at a local or regional level, not at a level that is threatening the overall species.
Megan Racy is a spokesperson for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who says regulators will continue to monitor harvest levels and other stressors for the eel, which serves as prey for other fish, mammals, and birds, and which is often an indicator of river health.
While this status review has determined that the eel overall as a worldwide population is stable, that does not change our agency's commitment to conserving the species.
In arguing for listing the species as threatened, the California-based Center for Environmental Science, Accuracy, and Reliability said eels have lost more than 80% of their habitat and suffer from commercial fishing pressure. Maine elvers used in sushi were worth more than $2,100 per pound in 2015. This is the second time the service has evaluated the American eel and found listing not warranted. For MPBN News, I'm Susan Sharon.
Coming right up, a new citizens initiative that would give a big boost to state education funding and keeping tabs on the rideshare service Uber. Did he violate the law? That's what some are asking today after it came to light that Governor Paul LePage kept secret until this week his creation of a special panel to review the Maine Human Rights Commission. LePage created the special panel through an April 21st executive order, but he didn't notify the Legislative Council and Legislative Reference Library, the Portland Press-Herald reports. The panel was created in the aftermath of a clash between the governor and the commission's executive director, Amy Sneerson, after LePage attempted to intervene in a discrimination case involving Moody's Diner in Waldoboro. LePage threatened to investigate, and the executive order was drafted a month later. The executive order indicates that the review will not take place in public. Meanwhile, Maine Family Planning, which provides reproductive health care services, is suing the State Department of Health and Human Services. Family Planning is seeking to overturn a DHHS order to repay $185,000 it billed to MaineCare for services provided to pregnant women considering abortions. The Bangor Daily News reports that Maine Family Planning is alleging that DHHS reinterpreted its own rules regarding what services should and shouldn't be covered by MaineCare, the state Medicaid program. More than 400 bills are making their way through the legislative pipeline, including several controversial proposals dealing with the disposal of fetal tissue, firearms background checks, and new restrictions on the power of the governor's office. But as A.J. Higgins reports, legislative leaders appear inclined to reject the overwhelming majority of the measures.
The two top leaders of the legislature say the 10-member legislative council charged with making the final determination on which new bills will make it into next year's legislative session will apply strict criteria when making their choices. And some choices may be easier to make than others. Representative Larry Lockman, a Republican from Amherst, thinks it's time to start randomly drug testing lawmakers. While House Majority Leader Jeff McCabe of Skowhegan wants to require the governor to promptly fill vacant commission slots. Republican Senate President Mike Thibodeau from Winterport says bills trying to make a political statement won't make it.
If there's something that's politically motivated that is, not truly an emergency nature, it's highly unlikely that it would get through.
House Speaker Mark Eaves, a Democrat from North Berwick, agrees. He says leaders have to limit new bills to true emergency matters because hundreds of bills, some that are very complicated, have been held over for consideration in January.
They do truly need to be time-sensitive or emergency in nature. And a lot of the bills that we've seen so far, particularly the ones that have gotten more attention, whether it's around Planned Parenthood, another thing, those just aren't going to go anywhere.
Because of political divisions in the Maine legislature, each party holds 5 seats on the legislative council, setting the stage for a number of deadlocked votes if consideration should happen to divide along party lines. The legislative council will meet October 22nd to hear personally from the bill's sponsors, who briefly will explain why the legislation is needed. If the bill fails to attract a majority vote from the panel, lawmakers will get one more opportunity to appeal the decision next month before the legislature returns in January. For MPBN News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
For those who can't get no satisfaction from the legislature, there's the Citizens Initiative process. It's been 12 years since voters approved an initiative requiring the state to fund 55% of the cost of public education in Maine. The state, though, has never met that threshold. Instead, towns have increasingly been forced to raise property taxes and cut services in an effort to make up the difference. Now, a coalition of students, parents, teachers, and community members are asking voters to weigh in again. As Jay Field reports, a November 2016 ballot measure seeks to raise $110 million for public education by requiring the state's wealthiest residents to pay more in taxes.
Amanda Cooper teaches 8th grade English and social studies at Gorham Middle School. Cooper has been a classroom teacher in Maine for 15 years. When she started out, Cooper says her average class size was between 17 and 22 kids. Now, because of decreased funding, ed tech and teacher positions have been cut in recent years, and class sizes have jumped to as many as 27 students.
It's a lot of kids. Sometimes we don't have enough desks.
Cooper says that's made life in the classroom tough on Gorham Middle School's remaining teachers and their students.
That significantly impacts students, particularly special education students, who sometimes have some pretty significant needs.
These dynamics are playing out in countless schools and communities across the state, be they rural, suburban, or urban. Teresa Gillies has 2 kids in school in Brunswick, where she teaches music and her husband runs a tree care business. Her son, who's in junior high school, loves science.
They really have had to cut back on experiments in the junior high specifically. Just no funding to even keep the gas, hooked up in the science labs.
Gillies says Brunswick, like many communities in recent years, has had to raise property taxes in an effort to fill the gaps. But this dynamic is becoming increasingly unsustainable as many homeowners see their wages remain flat and the number of people living on fixed incomes in Maine goes up as the state's population continues to age.
Yeah, we really need to get more help funding our schools.
That reality has led Gillies and Amanda Cooper to throw their support behind a proposed Citizens Initiative designed to do just that. The Stand Up for Students campaign, launched Wednesday afternoon in Portland, asks voters to approve a measure to raise $110 million for Maine schools. Under the plan, wealthy Maine households would pay an additional $30 in taxes for every additional $1,000 they make over $200,000. The proposal, though, is likely to trigger a political fight at a time when Republican Governor Paul LePage is backing a voter referendum to eliminate the state income tax. The Maine Heritage Policy Center, a conservative think tank, and the group Maine Taxpayers United did not return requests for comment by airtime. John Costin, who supports the Stand Up for Students initiative, runs Veneer Services Unlimited, a small business in Kennebunk. I asked Costin what he would say to customers of his who might complain that it's simply unfair to make the state's wealthy residents responsible for making sure that Maine honors its pledge to pay 55% of the cost of public education.
Well, I would say that an investment in K-12 education is an investment that pays dividends to all Mainers. And unfortunately, the burden of not making that investment really falls the heaviest on the least affluent Mainers.
Supporters must collect 62,000 signatures for the Stand Up for Students initiative to appear on the November 2016 ballot. For MPBN News, I'm Jay Field.
In Portland, city officials are proposing a measure that would grant some municipal oversight of independent transportation companies, such as the rideshare service Uber. It's an attempt to partially roll back a bill enacted by the state legislature earlier this year that effectively gives operators like Uber freedom from municipal control as long as they meet certain state standards. It's also a response to concerns raised by Portland taxi drivers who serve the Portland Jetport and say their livelihoods are being threatened by an unfair playing field. Tom Porter has the story.
Bashir Sharia is one of a handful of taxi drivers waiting outside baggage claim at the Portland Jetport one recent weekday afternoon. He runs the airport cab taxi service, operating 18 cabs, two of which he owns, and all of which have to pay the city more than $800 a year for a permit to wait inside the airport to pick up customers. They also have to impose a $1.50 surcharge for each fare collected at the Jetport. Sharia says life is getting increasingly hard for him and his drivers because Uber cars, which incoming travellers can summon via a smartphone app, don't have to follow any of these regulations.
We have seen a long line of Uber in front of the terminal, and we are here, people going there, so they destroy our business.
More of his drivers are staying at home, he says, and if this goes on, he'll be out of business soon.
We don't mind any competition. If they come here and pay what we pay, we are ready to accept that.
While the cabbies are concerned about fair competition, for airport officials, it's more a question of traffic flow and customer safety.
We really can't have commercial vehicles dwelling immediately outside of baggage claim, but that's the incentive under the TNC program.
Jetport director Paul Bradbury is referring here to transportation network companies, in this case Uber. Under their model, it's the driver closest to the customer who gets the fare, which incentivizes Uber drivers to idle outside baggage claim and in the nearby cell phone lot, even though they're technically not allowed to do so unless they have a designated pickup. Airport officials can and do move on Uber drivers who are seen to be loitering, says Bradbury, but new legislation that's being proposed would make it easier to control the situation.
Really, all we need is to have the ability to regulate TNCs at the airport, and this statute would allow us to do that. And we would simply put it into our normal ground transportation rules that are posted for commercial operators at the airport. But under the current state statute, we can't post rules that would apply to a TNC.
A bill passed this summer requires TNCs in Maine to abide by statewide insurance and safety regulations and prohibits municipalities from adopting their own regulations. The law also requires Uber to pay a $10,000 annual fee to the state. Having heard complaints from the Jetport, Democratic State Senator Anne Haskell of Portland is drafting legislation that would return some of this oversight to municipalities. She's concerned that Uber drivers at the airport appear to be in direct competition with the taxi cabs.
Which is fine, but if they're going to be in competition at the airport itself, they should have to obey the same parking and movement restrictions that the taxi cabs do.
Haskell says her bill, which is still being crafted, would not seek to regulate the activity of TNCs outside the Portland Jetport. But city manager Jonathan Jennings says he would like to see the change expanded citywide.
Municipalities are responsible for regulating taxi cabs, and we feel that Uber and other similar companies should be regulated at the municipal level.
Mostly to protect the consumer, he says, but also to introduce a level playing field. Jennings says the state legislation enacted earlier this year was unfair to Maine's municipalities.
We as a community have no ability whatsoever to place any type of regulation on these vehicles.
But the state representative who sponsored this year's TNC legislation stands by its intent.
TNCs are fundamentally different than taxis.
Waterville Democrat Henry Beck.
Taxis traditionally have been regulated at the municipal level, and that's how we should leave this. We shouldn't disrupt the law after it's been in effect for less than a year.
Uber declined to provide comment for this story. For MPBN News, I'm Tom Porter.
And that's the news on this day in Maine, Wednesday, October 7th, 2015. Our theme music was composed by Robert Holt. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall and Susan Sharon, and to Mal Leary, Patty White, Jay Field, Tom Porter, Ed Morin, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to know what you think about the program. Email us at tdim@mpbn.net. That's tdim@mpbn.net. I'm Barbara Caritti. For all of us here at MPBN News, thanks for listening.